Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Carl Stair, practitioner of nonviolent communication, who uses these methods for conflict resolution and building interpersonal relationships. I was exposed to nonviolent communication through my interview with Dylan Neighbor Cruz, one of my permaculture teachers, and in exploring these ideas, see it as a powerful way for us to connect with one another meaningfully in a space that allows for others and both ourselves to communicate well with each other, and in turn to build a better world. In addition to his own biography and background, Carl tells a story during this interview that walks us through the four steps of nonviolent communication, of observation, feeling, understanding need, and making a request. And he does that in a rather personal way from his own life. Now then, let's listen to Carl Stair. I'll join you afterwards with some thoughts and updates. Well then, Mr. Stair, if you are ready to begin, could you give us a little bit of your biography and background, how you came to do what you're doing, and then we can proceed with the conversation about nonviolent communication.
Wonderful. Thanks, Scott. Yeah, in the moment, I feel excited for this exploration. The intersection of permaculture and nonviolent communication is one that I'm really passionate about. Certainly a lot more of my work has been in nonviolent communication professionally, but I've also often thought of nonviolent communication as simply another manifestation of the permaculture principles and vice versa, permaculture being a manifestation of nonviolent communication principles in a different domain. So my bio and background, it's eclectic in a lot of ways. I think of myself as, from a young age, being really passionate about creating community and trying to find ways that I could make the world a better place, being a young idealist. And that involved being a first grader, trying to organize a rally in my first grade class to create more kind of inclusiveness. I don't think I used the word inclusiveness, but I knew that I wanted more of a sense of care and friendliness among the first graders. So that has taken me in a lot of different places, a lot of different countries and settings over the years. After I graduated from college, which involved time as a volunteer in Nepal, doing work with Mother Teresa's organization and studying anthropology. But after college, I traveled overseas and really found myself very curious about how to live a life, as Joseph Campbell described, of following your bliss. And not just for hedonistic reasons, but realizing that I had disconnected from what I might call my intrinsic motivation, my natural impulse for aliveness, joy, love, celebration, creation, which I believe is everyone's essence on the planet. And through some reading, through some exploration, I began to realize how dampened down a lot of my aliveness had become by the time I was in college. That I was kind of going through these motions of, okay, I need to go to college, I need to get a job, I need to get a certain kind of job because of this is my education, et cetera. And it felt a bit too mechanical. And I didn't find myself passionate about a lot of my classes in school. And so that led me after college on this sort of bohemian adventure of finding what am I really passionate about. And over many years, and unless you want to hear more, I won't go into all the different details, but it took me to being an environmental educator and naturalist. I worked with environmental and social change nonprofits in DC and California, and ended up going back to school, in grad school after a few years out of school, where I studied both anthropology and environmental policy at the University of Michigan. And during all of that exploration, I came upon the global eco-village network and this whole concept of eco-villages. And that intersection of community, sustainability, and creating an intentional space where folks were experimenting with creating a more life-serving culture really turned me on. It just captured my interest. While I was in grad school, I was living in a student co-op, and I found cooperative living to really shift my awareness in some powerful ways and help me wake up to interdependence. So all of this was before I got exposed to nonviolent communication, but I knew I was passionate about community. I knew I was passionate about sustainability and about consciousness. And so when I finished up with grad school, I ended up going to a place called Findhorn, an eco-village in Scotland. And that was now 15 years ago that I first went there. And during that visit, actually, is the first time I heard about nonviolent communication. I don't know if it's the first time I heard about permaculture, but it was probably around the same time that I learned about things like permaculture. And I got to experience this pretty different paradigm of living, where people were living, and I ultimately ended up moving to Findhorn and living there for 3 years, a few years after grad school, but where I would walk 5 minutes to work, where I knew everybody in my community on a face-to-face, first-name basis, and where I could see the windmills where my power came from, and I saw the gardens where my food was grown, and I ate meals in a community center where I was among friends and people interested in the same sorts of things. And nonviolent communication, that was the first time I heard about nonviolent communication, because it was one of the many tools that this experimental kind of community was exploring. But it was not until 10 years ago, in 2003, that I began to dive a little deeper into what nonviolent communication is. And so the last 10 years, it's been a big part of what I do. And a lot of what I do is also sustainable community building. I do consulting. I facilitate something called restorative circles, which is an approach to restorative justice. But in essence, if I were to distill it down, I'm interested in how can individuals and communities invite that flow of aliveness, love, passion that shows up in empathy, authenticity, presence in the world that I think not only is joyful to live, but also allows us to be more of service to each other and to help create a planet that is a lot healthier. So I'm going to pause there. I know that was an unconventional bio narrative, but that gives you a little flavor of some of the touch points.
For this show, that is a completely standard kind of response.
Great.
Because
I'm so glad to hear that.
It's about the narrative of how we come to where we are. And it's looking back, I know in my own life, I could make it a very simple story. You know, I did ABC and here's where I am. But there is a complexity to it. There are many different things that happen to bring each of us to where we are. And part of wanting to speak with you and Dominic Barter and some of the other people in the NVC community is because I want to explore more of the social and economic aspects of permaculture and how we can work on those things. And it's funny because many of the things that you mentioned in your biography, there are keywords there that I could just check off from my own story.
Uh-huh.
And also some of my own work now because of that idea of finding your bliss or finding your calling. Being able to have that space in order to do that productively and being able to find your own way and to borrow from Mark Lakeman so that we can inhabit our own story and not someone else's.
Beautiful.
And Findhorn is a place that I've heard about quite a bit, and I think I'm going to have to do a little bit more research. From there and all the places that you've gone, so with your background in nonviolent communication, what has that experience been like for you? And what kind of work you do with it? Though I guess really, let's back up a little. And could you explain what nonviolent communication is?
Sure. I think there are many ways that it could be described. There's no one definitive definition, but I experience nonviolent communication as actually operating on two levels. There's a form or a process, which includes some, what I find, very powerful differentiations, which help support us to stay connected to ourselves, to what's alive in us, what our needs are, what our emotions are, our feelings in any one moment, and to be aware of and to be empathically curious about what other people's needs are in a situation or in life on the planet, and to invite a way of relating where everyone's needs are held with care. And again, the two different levels, there's the level of a form or a process which nonviolent communication offers as a series of differentiations about being aware of clear observations, being aware of our feelings, being aware of needs, being aware of how we can make requests rather than demands. So that's the level of process. But then at a deeper level, there's simply a consciousness which isn't exclusive to nonviolent communication, but certainly is the essence of it, which is how can we show up in the world in a way where we're present to our own authenticity, speaking from that place. Well, you might also call that speaking from the heart, and also listening to others with empathy, with compassion, with an openness to care for their well-being as well as our own. And so in that sense, the consciousness of interdependence, how do we make a world that works for everyone? So it's both that broader consciousness as well as the specific process that I think of as being nonviolent communication. I mean, I could give a little bit of background about how I specifically got involved with nonviolent communication and what that looked and felt like. That aspect of the narrative is one that I often share when I do an introduction to nonviolent communication, and I think may have some meaning for folks.
Yeah, let's go with that.
So when I first got involved more deeply with nonviolent communication just over 10 years ago, it was around the time of the buildup to the first Iraq War. And I was living in the United States at the time. And I remember vividly looking at an article in the newspaper, and there's a photo of a demonstration. And in this photo, there were two men facing each other. And one side of the photo was a man in his 30s with a button-down shirt, and he was leaning across a barricade, and it looked like he was screaming because the veins were sticking out of his neck, and his mouth was wide open. And on the other side of the photo was a man a bit older, maybe in his 50s, with a beard, and he was leaning across the barricade also with veins sticking out of his neck, yelling back at the first man. And at the bottom of the photo was the caption, "A pro-war and an anti-war activist in dialogue." I don't remember exactly how they described it, but I remember something in my stomach sinking when I saw that photo, because something about it was deeply familiar with what I had been experiencing in a lot of my work as an activist, as an environmental activist, as a peace or anti-war activist, as a social change activist. That sense of two people yelling at each other, and I distinctly just had the thought, wow, they are not hearing each other. And that certainly has been my experience now in working with conflict quite a lot in my life now, is that when people are upset to the point of raising their voices, they're raising their voices so that they can be heard. And typically, my experience is that neither person is being heard. And there's actually a wall or an increasing gap between the two people in those moments. And so that same week that I saw that photo, I read an article in the Sun magazine. And in that article is an interview with Marshall Rosenberg, who is the man who sort of created the distinctions that are the process of nonviolent communication, drawing on his deep study of psychology and various spiritual traditions. And in this interview, he talked about what it would be like to empathize, and in fact, he had done this, empathizing with someone who is for the war and someone who is against the war. And in empathizing or deeply listening to both of those individuals, he said, we would realize that both of them are actually longing for safety and well-being for their family. That underneath these vastly different strategies and underneath these two individuals yelling at each other across a barricade were some common human values for understanding, for well-being, of one's family for security. And that he had found in his work around the world in war zones, in hospitals, in prisons, he had found that when people could hear each other at the level of what he called universal human needs, these basic values like security, like understanding, love, family, well-being, that when people hear each other at that level, what used to be a conflict can begin to open into something much more collaborative. Even people I found in my work who are completely at odds, can hardly even speak to each other when they come into the room together, when they're able to hear the basic human needs that they both share, they begin to see each other's humanity and recognize what connects them. And so reading this article had a huge impact on me. I'd been an activist for a number of years, and I'd realized how often I had approached it with a lot of fire and a lot of self-righteousness. And I had wondered how, you know, I'd get in these arguments with university administrators at my graduate school about, like, we need to be more sustainable. The university is completely wasteful. And I would get this pushback from the administration. And I found myself curious once when the president of the business school agreed to facilitate a conversation between myself and the vice president of the university, who I had had acrimonious and somewhat angry conversations with on numerous occasions, and I found him so intractable. But when the president of the business school, who I was a little suspicious of, because at that time I really was like, I couldn't imagine that he would offer understanding from my perspective, he sat with us, and he sat and he invited me to speak about what mattered to me. And I spoke about how we need to be more sustainable on campus and the ways that we could do that. And he listened and he empathized. He reflected back what he was hearing from me. And I thought, wow, this guy's great. He's totally sympathetic to where I'm coming from. This is awesome. And then he turned to the vice president of business operations and he asked him what was going on for him. And he spoke about his concern about where the university was at and what was fiscally responsible and what was doable change within the time frame. And the president listened to him. And I was taken aback. I thought, wow, like, he's really hearing this guy. And I was so touched and moved and inspired by how this man listened to both of us. And we both felt like he was on our side, and a completely different conversation became possible, holding both of our needs. So this is a little flashback I'm mentioning that resonated with me when I read this article interviewing Marshall Rosenberg, and I thought, this is what I've been longing for. I've been longing to feel my passion for social change, for environmental change, for creating a more peaceful world, but to do it by building bridges, by helping people connect and understand each other. And so I voraciously read the rest of this interview where Marshall talked about going into prisons and helping women who had experienced sexual assault or rape, how he would support dialogue between them and the men who had done these things, and how through healing dialogue, he would help a mutual understanding occur and a self-responsibility occur on the part of the men, which was much deeper than any punishment seemed to lead to transformation. The depth of hearing that occurred on both sides led to a healing that it moved me so much to read about. And I've actually been involved in similar work in the 10 years since I read that interview. And so that article and the timing of it in my life was such a huge gift and such an impetus to dive into nonviolent communication, to find a way. And it's taken many years for me to find the way to try to embody it more fully, because I had so many habitual ways of thinking and communicating in the way of just this way of being present and available both to myself, my own feelings and needs, and to the feelings and needs of others. So that's a bit of my origin story in coming to nonviolent communication.
I can't say that I came to the place that I'm in today in a way that would even be considered parallel to your path at all. I was never an activist. I grew up in a relatively conservative area and in a conservative way. But thank you for that story, because for me, I feel a little less alone in the world with the work that I'm doing and the things that I'd like to accomplish. And it was something that a friend of mine said to me once that I'm still trying to reconcile, that internal versus external perspective that we have. In that I asked him one time how he was doing, and before he answered that question, he just stopped and looked at me and he said, "You know, I really like it when you ask me how I'm doing because you want to hear the answer." There's something about that. And in a lot of what you just shared with us, many of the thoughts that I've been going through recently as I tried to figure out some of these social hurdles and economic hurdles within permaculture and really building a better world and a permanent civilization is about how can we have dialogue and find the things that we have in common with others. Because I have friends who I have very little that I share with when it comes to a political, religious, or even a social context, except for our friendship. And we can sit and be diametrically opposed to one another on a topic, but because we can have a dialogue and respect the place where the other one comes from, we can accept those differences and be confident in the things that we share.
Yeah, thanks, Scott. I mean, it's absolutely my experience as well, that if we are willing to listen at a deeper level, if we're willing to see and hear people with a fresh openness to seeing what it is that they long for, what it is that they value, I'm struck again and again by the potential for connection and even collaboration where I might have thought it was impossible before. One place where I find this more than anywhere else is when I go into prison as a volunteer. So I've volunteered in a few prisons in California and here in Washington State where I currently live. And every time I'm touched and inspired anew by the profundity of human connection that I experience. Before I'd ever gone into prison, I felt a distinct care for the men who were incarcerated, but I certainly saw them as other, and I found myself with a good degree of fear of experiencing intimacy or connection with them or being in the same room with them for that matter. And what I found again and again is that when I share from my vulnerability about what it is that I value, and when I'm open to and invite them to share at that level as well, we meet in a place that I hardly met with anyone before I came to this kind of work, because I hear their struggles with missing their family. I hear the depth of remorse that they have in the impact of their actions on others. I hear the longing they have for more freedom and dignity in their lives. And when I hear them at that level, I also find they're my teacher in such profound ways. And the same can be done in any kind of environment where we might experience someone as another, let's say someone of a different political persuasion, or I was involved somewhat with the Occupy movement. And, you know, how can we have a dialogue between folks who are in a lot of pain about the financial inequality on the planet, the treatment of the natural world, and folks who have the label of being in the 1%? How can we invite the possibility of a collaborative dialogue there? I recognize it may seem like a real challenge, and I want to hold out the possibility that these dialogues, in my experience, are quite possible if we remember that every organization, every government, every corporation is comprised of human beings who, however tragically they may be making their choices in action at times, that underneath are basic human motivations, basic longings for well-being, for recognition, for love, for acceptance.
Your mention of sharing your own vulnerability. When I interviewed Dave Jackie a few months ago, as part of our interview, he was very candid and very honest, to the point that there were some things that we later decided were best not to share publicly. But in that, he said, you know, let's take this back to 1984. Vulnerability is strength. And I'm reading Mark Kurlansky's Nonviolence right now, which is a history. Well, what is the subtitle for it? The History of a Dangerous Idea. So it's more of a historical overview of this concept. And one of the things that he mentioned in there that really got to me is that our language to talk about something, about being nonviolent, is that it's not violence, but that we don't have a word that represents that directly, that then the negation of that word would be a representation of violence. We glorify in many ways war and conflict, and that it's, for me at least, I find it's hard sometimes to try to have these conversations because they sound ephemeral or wishy-washy or easily dismissed because they seem like flights of fancy. But that's just some of my struggle with this, is to be able to be as open and honest as I can be so that we can have greater depth of dialogue and really represent those needs that people have and in many cases are unable to express because of the story that society tells about how they should be or how they should act when there's pain and suffering there that can't be addressed.
Hearing you speak to that, I particularly when you speak of sort of the perception perhaps of something like nonviolence as being wishy-washy or distant, I find it so meaningful to speak to the fact that while nonviolent communication is sometimes called compassionate communication, and I certainly find it being a path of compassion, by the same token, I also see it as a path of empowerment. And I don't want to separate the two. So in that way, it's both about being empathic and receptive to the needs of others, as well as fully valuing, connecting to, and expressing our own authenticity and aliveness, and taking action in relation to it. So in that way, it's not a giving up of our own ground in favor of care for others, but it's truly caring for our own needs and well-being, staying grounded in that, being self-full. I like to use the term self-full rather than selfish. Self-full as we also recognize our shared humanity with other humans and our common connection to all life on the planet. And so in that sense, again, it's so in harmony with the permaculture principles of planet care, people care, fair share, that those concepts are perfectly intertwined within the essence of nonviolent communication.
My exposure to nonviolent communication was one of my permaculture mentors, colleagues, friends, was living in an intentional community in Hawaii, and they were using Dr. Rosenberg's book, Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life, and he recommended that I read that, and they were also doing some co-counseling in order to communicate clearly within their organization. As part of that, I would recommend certainly that anybody read the book. Mine has all kinds of notes and underlining and other things. But could you walk us through a bit of what nonviolent communication, that process is like, and also give us a bit of information if someone would want to get involved in this after, say, reading Dr. Rosenberg's book and wanting to explore it further?
Yeah, so to walk through the essence of the process, I often tell a story from about 10, 15 years ago with my father, a situation with my father, which feels so relevant to my own journey in relation to this work. So at that time of this conversation with my father, I hadn't been exposed to nonviolent communication. And he had, about 10 years earlier than that, stopped talking to his father. So my grandfather and my father weren't speaking. My father had a lot of upset about some things that had happened between himself and his father. And so the connection was pretty much gone, and there was no communication. And I was home visiting my father at the time, and I brought up a conversation I'd had with my grandfather and mentioned to my father that my grandfather was in the hospital. And my father turned to me and he said, "You're a traitor. You don't care about me." And at the time, all I could do was just sputter and get really frustrated and angry back. And I turned to him and I just said, "You know, how can you talk to me this way? Like, that's so unreasonable. Like, what, you know, what's your problem?" And the conversation just degenerated from there. We had two upset people just blowing off steam and not going anywhere. And one of us stormed out of the room, and that was it. And had I at that time had the awareness of what I spoke to earlier on this call about universal human needs, I would have responded in a very different way. And in fact, in the 10 or so years since I've begun my work with and deepened my work with nonviolent communication, I found myself having repeats of that conversation with my father, but with a very different response and a very different outcome. And so I'll just walk you through how my response might have been different had I been aware of these human needs and also of my feelings in that moment. So the first thing that I invite folks to do when in a challenging situation, or really in any situation, even if we're having a great time, I find it really supportive to start by getting self-connected. So connecting to ourselves, and this could take just a moment, a second or two, or it could take an hour. But, you know, for myself in a live conversation with my dad, I might just take, even if it's 30 seconds, just to pause, take a deep breath, because breath is a great way to slow down an intense situation and bring some more oxygen online and switch from the reptilian brain into something a little bit more reflective. And just notice what's happening inside of me. And while I may not say these words out loud to my father, internally, I can name to myself, what are my observation, feeling, need, and if there's a request that I might have in that situation. So for me, internally, that would look like a very brief inner reflection on, wow, when I hear my dad saying that to me, I feel frustrated. And underneath that frustration, I feel fear. And what's underneath that frustration and fear? Oh, what I'm needing is I'm really longing for understanding and some connection. And I want to be seen, actually, for my care for my dad and my care for my grandfather. And my request to myself in that moment might be to just allow myself to notice what's happening in that moment. So just even silently doing that sort of checklist in myself, while it's taken me some time to get fluent in it, has become an amazingly powerful way to self-regulate an intense conversation, along with breath, along with just putting some awareness on my body sensations. From there, I then have two options. I can express myself to my father, and I can also offer some empathic listening to him, whether that's me listening to him silently with empathic presence, or whether that's through verbally making a guess at what it is that's going on for him. What might he be feeling and needing in that moment? And so what I find myself often doing is, because if I'm recognizing, I'm guessing he's pretty upset if he's saying these things to me in the way that he did, I am finding myself curious and I offer an empathic reflection. So I might say, after my father has said, "You're a traitor, you don't care about me," after I've self-connected, I might say, "Papa, I'm wondering if you're really frustrated and want some understanding of how upset you are about your connection with your father." And in my experience, that has opened up a completely different conversation with my father. While he may not immediately soften, me offering just some curiosity about what's happening for him by guessing at, "Hey, are you feeling pissed off because you really want to be understood for your pain?" I may or may not be right about it, about my guess, but that curiosity invites a different kind of response. He has a sense of being heard or seen or cared about in a different way than with my habitual kind of fighting back with him. And as I was just saying before, I don't want to only empathize. I also want to express myself. So if I notice my father shifting and, you know, relaxing a bit, which I usually find with a little bit of empathy that I see him soften, then I might also say, "Hey, Papa, do you feel able to hear what's going on for me in the moment?" If I have a sense of an opening there, I would offer, "Hey, I hear how upset you are, and I want you to know how much I care about you and our connection. It matters a lot to me that we have a loving, supportive connection. And I recognize, even though if it's tough for you, I also want to be able to have a relationship with my grandfather. And I know that that brings up a lot for you. And I hope that we can find a way that you can find acceptance for that, but this is something that's really important to me. So that kind of a dialogue where I'm both being empathic and caring toward my dad's well-being and needs, as well as expressing my own needs and what I'm longing for, has led to a profoundly different relationship with my father. So that's walking through a specific conversation that has really made a difference in my life.
Thank you for taking the time to share that. I can think of some times in my own life where I've had conversations that have, well, gone poorly because of not stopping to self-reflect and realize the place that I come from and how that affects everything else, and that those ideas of projection or casting, you know, our own feelings out on others because of the place that we're in that moment.
And Scott, you had asked also about ways that people could explore more if they're intrigued and hungry for more specific and more in-depth exploration of nonviolent communication. There are great resources of a variety of kinds for experiencing nonviolent communication. You mentioned Marshall Rosenberg's book, Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Life. There are many other resources as well. A great global portal for these resources are through the Center for Nonviolent Communication. And that's the website for that organization is www.cnvc.org. So Center for Nonviolent Communication.org, CNVC. And that organization is based in New Mexico, but really nonviolent communication is a global phenomenon being shared. There are trainers leading trainings, various events, learning opportunities around the world, and certainly across the United States. You can find trainers and learning events through the cnvc.org website. There are also regional ones, for example, here in the Pacific Northwest in the Puget Sound area. We have our own regional nonviolent communication organization that people can visit, and the same for areas like the Bay Area. So there are sort of sub-organizations that are affiliated with the Center for Nonviolent Communication, as well as certified trainers with the Center of Nonviolent Communication. And other ways that folks can learn, there are DVDs, there are audio recordings of Marshall Rosenberg and other certified trainers. So I definitely invite folks to find, if at all possible, finding in-person learning events. I find to be profoundly supportive to the integration of this work, because reading in a book, while it certainly can offer something, it's a bit like trying to learn permaculture through just reading a book. I find that you have to get your hands in the dirt. You need to, you know, get out there and actually see things in action. And similarly for nonviolent communication, engaging with other human beings face to face is such a profound way to really get this into our bones. And that leads me to one other strategy, which is joining or creating your own nonviolent communication practice group is a wonderful way to deepen with a group of friends or neighbors or colleagues. And there's a workbook, a companion workbook to the nonviolent communication book, that actually offers a template for creating and facilitating those kinds of practice groups. And that's a book that you can also find at the cnvc.org website, the companion workbook to the nonviolent communication book. And it's written by a woman named Lucy Liu, who has done a lot of work with NVC in the prison system. So those are some great resources I highly recommend to folks. Oh, and I realize too, if anyone's interested in sort of my own approach to bringing nonviolent communication and restorative circles and community building into various communities in the world, I have a website at findflow.org. So it's findflow.org, and glad to support folks in the ways that I'm able.
And I will ensure that there are links to all of those in the show notes to make it easier for folks to be able to find you, the Center for Nonviolent Communication, and the other materials that you shared with us.
Wonderful. Thanks, Scott.
Well, I shouldn't say we've covered everything that I wanted to in this conversation. I could probably talk to you for hours about this, process and the stories that go with it and what it's like to work in prisons and around the world. However, for the time that we allotted for this conversation, we're coming to a close. With that in mind, is there anything else that you would like to add to this conversation for the listeners?
I'm just really grateful to have any opportunity to speak about this work and the impact that I've experienced it having. I see it as one of the really profound gifts and tools that those of us interested in creating a world that works for everyone, that is sustainable, thriving, and resilient. I found that this aspect of communication and how we engage around conflict and how we actually harvest the rich energy that's contained within conflict and find the gift in it is so, so essential. So I'm always pleased to have an opportunity to share it, and I hope that it nourishes and serves others in some way. So thanks so much, Scott.
Thank you for joining me, Carl. I appreciate every time that I get to speak with someone and get to expand my understanding of a topic and in turn get to share it with the world. I'm sure that this will help many people who are on this path with us to building a better world.
Thank you.
And that was Carl Steyer. When it comes to this conversation with Carl, was his comment about habitual ways of thinking and communicating. Though I don't go out and yell it from the rooftops, I look at a long, slow, subtle, and almost, if you will, subversive way of bringing about change. In order to build a better world, we have to think differently and act differently. And this conversation with Carl is just the first of several that I have planned, just as I'm doing the Faith and Earthcare series on doing a nonviolent and restorative justice series to tap more into the work that's being done on the social side of taking care of the earth, ourselves, and each other, so that regardless of what the future may hold, we have a way to better respond to the events in the world around us and to take action in a meaningful way for ourselves and others that doesn't continue to propagate these old ways of doing, and where, regardless of our direction, background, or perspective, we can come together. And even though we might be angry and heated about something, that between us, in that space, a dialogue and a conversation can occur that meets not only our own needs, but those of others. If you have thoughts, comments, questions, you know someone else who's doing this kind of work that you'd like to recommend for the show, please let me know. Email, as always, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Give me a call, 717-827-6266. Join in the conversation at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or send me a tweet. I'm on Twitter @permaculturecst. As I say in these shows, they are listener supported. So please, if you're able, lend me a hand. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support and make a contribution if you're able. If you're not, let other people know about the show. It continues to grow in new and incredible ways that I'm always surprised by when I get phone calls from people who are listening just to say hello, or that they've just started now because of the people who they've been able to hear have all kinds of questions and want to know more. Help me continue to do this work by letting people know. And a part of that is by going to your favorite podcast sites, such as iTunes or others, and leave a review. Let people know what you enjoy about the show. If you are interested in a more formal way of learning about permaculture, I've opened up the registration for the next rounds of online permaculture design courses. They've been changed since last year in the way that they're being offered, as there's both a 6-month and a 12-month, but still in a mentored, project-based approach. And that's going to bring this episode to a close. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other.